Welcome to Single Malt History with Gareth Russell, pouring out your serving of pure, distilled, intoxicating, and occasionally delicious history. On a miserable and overcast February evening in 1917, a westward bound sleeper train slipped out of Vienna, shuffling through the narrow carriage corridor until he found the door leading to his own first-class sleeping compartment. Hungarian aristocrat Count Tomás Erdődy, 30 years old, trim, of medium height, let himself into his room and settled in for the night as the train trundled across the heartlands of the Habsburg Empire. That empire, known by a bewildering kaleidoscope of names as the centuries wore on and the borders extended and contracted, looked out of fashion by the second decade of the 20th century. Even the empire's most passionate defenders worried about its future, and Russia's Tsar Nicholas II was not alone in his confident prediction that Austria's empire would have gone within a generation. Europe was by then obsessed with the idea of nationalism, of nationhood, defined by independent states with their own borders, which would be defined by a shared culture, language, and a nationally agreed upon sense of collective history. Nationalism had been elevated almost into a secular religion in the 19th century. By the 20th, it looked set to capsize the multinational Habsburg Empire, with its two capital cities, multiple languages, multiple parliaments, and 11 different ethnic groups. The idea that 11 different peoples could live in a single state was, to nationalism's mind, an absurdity, a contradiction in terms. And since at least 1848, the supremely federalist Austro-Hungarian Empire, as it had been since 1867, had been struggling to justify and defend its continued existence. Count Erdődy's family had been loyal to the ruling House of Habsburg since the Middle Ages, and he himself was named after a celebrated ancestor who had fought in their long-ago wars against the Ottoman sultans. The Erdődys, like the Habsburgs whom they served, struggled to adapt to the new nationalist certainties sweeping Europe. The Erdődy dynasty were nominally Hungarian, but along with their beautiful 19th century French-designed country seat in Hungary, they had a palace in Vienna and large estates in Croatia, also part of the empire. With the empire already battling its internal nationalist tensions, it could no longer afford to take part in the external pressures off the Great War that had started 3 years before Count Erdödy's train journey. The old emperor, the beloved Franz Josef, who had taken Austria into what was later called the First World War, had died 4 months earlier in November 1916 after 68 years on the imperial throne. The old emperor's death had plunged most of the empire into mourning, and it had also heightened political fears about what lay ahead, as many people felt that the aged and respected emperor had been the one holding the empire together. There was particular worry among the Jewish communities in the east of the empire, where many Galician Jews in particular feared that the monarchy's collapse or its weakening would leave them exposed to the increasingly anti-Semitic influences popular in nationalism at the time. The succession to the throne had gone smoothly, however, to Franz Josef's next of kin and great-nephew, the 29-year-old Archduke Karl. To give an idea of the many different communities, histories, and languages embodied in his empire, the new monarch was Carlo to some of his subjects, Charles to others, Emperor Karl I in Austria, King Károly IV in Hungary, King Karel III in Bohemia. Count Erdödy had grown up with the new emperor. They were almost of the same age. Erdödy was only a few months older. And now that his friend Karl had acceded to the throne, Erdödy served as one of the new emperor's aides. it was this lifelong friendship that led to Erdödy being entrusted with the small package of documents that he took with him on that sleeper train out of Vienna, and which he could not allow out of his sight. Likewise, for the small map given to him by his master's wife, the Empress Zita. Whether Count Erdödy slept that night, we don't know. But in the small hours, the train came to a halt in the West Austrian city of Salzburg, where it rested for a few hours. Had it run without these stops, the train would have reached its destinations at an inconveniently early time. So the train company timetabled for prolonged halts to increase their passengers' sleep time and comfort. After sunrise, the train crossed the border into Switzerland, where Erdödy, along with the rest of the paying customers, presented his passport to border officials. When the train reached the Swiss town of Neuchâtel, Erdödy took the documents and the map with him as he disembarked into a train station filled with people making for the busier train routes onto Zurich or Geneva. Switzerland had remained neutral during the war that had convulsed the rest of Europe, consuming millions of lives, decimating even more hopes for the future. Using his map from the Empress, Erdödy walked about 15 or so minutes through a town already famous for its role in the Swiss watch industry and undimmed by any of the privations or grief that shackled a wartime Vienna. The Empress's map brought Erdödy to a narrow street, the Rue de Pommier, not too far from the waterfront. It was a narrow street where Erdödy found the two-storied house number 7, knocked on the door, and was shown up the stairs to a street-facing room with 3 windows. Waiting for him there were 2 brothers, the Empress's brothers, whom she had not seen for 3 years when she and they had backed different sides in the war. Count Erdödy bowed to the 2 men, and then, as per the Empress's unambiguous orders, he handed over a sealed envelope with the secret documents that she and the Emperor had entrusted to him. He placed them in the hands of the elder of the 2 brothers, His Highness Prince Sixtus of Bourbon-Parma, born in the same year as Erdödy, dressed as a civilian, although he was an officer in the Belgian army, tall, slender, with a neat moustache and dark hair that he typically wore slicked back. Then, without discussing anything of note, again, the Empress had been very clear about that, Count Erdödy bowed, left, and returned to the train station for his journey back to Austria. When he had gone, Prince Sixtus opened the envelope and read its contents with his brother, Prince Xavier, 3 years his junior and a fellow officer in the Belgian army. They had both joined that army with the personal permission of Belgium's king after the French government vetoed their initial offer to volunteer for its army in 1914. Sixtus and Xavier were both members of the deposed French royal family, and concerned about the continuing strength of pro-royalist sentiment within the French public, and especially in its armed forces, the French Republic had decided to uphold the so-called Law of Exile, which had, since 1886, banned members of the royal line from serving in the French army. This law was repealed in 1950. Nonetheless, the prince's ancestry continued to have a great deal of cachet, even among members of the French government who had nominally to uphold the anti-royalist exile laws. It was this that had catapulted the Bourbon-Parma brothers onto the stage of history in 1917. France's Prime Minister Charles de Freycinet had invited Prince Sixtus to meet with him privately in Paris in late 1916 to discuss the war, and in particular, Sixtus's relationship to Austria's new Empress consort. A faction in the Allies were convinced that their main quarrel lay with Imperial Germany, and if they could break the alliance between Germany and Austria, it would ensure that Germany could be defeated sooner. The German imperial government knew or suspected, thanks to their spies, that the Austrian government must realize how badly the war was going, Many in Austria blamed Germany or German aggression for the number of other countries that had come into the war against them. And this alliance between the two German-speaking empires had always been one of convenience rather than sentiment. Was there not some way, somehow, to open diplomatic back channels to Vienna, especially after the accession of a new emperor who might be prepared to adopt a more anti-war policy than his predecessor? Sixtus told the French Prime Minister that he had those thoughts himself. He had even discussed them a year earlier during a private audience at the Vatican with Pope Benedict XV. However, neither Sixtus nor his younger brother Xavier had seen their sister Zita since the summer the war began in 1914. As wife to the Austrian heir, Zita had firmly and unavoidably sided with Austria and her allies. While Sixtus and Xavier, loyal to the country of their ancestry and then of their refuge, sided with France, Belgium, and their allies. German spies were watching Zita in Austria for any sign of her attempting to promote an anti-war policy. Making contact with her in 1917 would not be easy for her brothers. But the family connection could not just be useful in function, but in form, because it could be used to disguise the reinitiating of contact. The Empress's widowed Portuguese mother, Maria Antonia, the Dowager Duchess of Parma, was naturally still in contact with both sides of the family. And so it was she who was approached about re-establishing contact between the brothers and their sisters. Neutral Switzerland could be used as a base for early discussions, with the Dowager Duchess travelling from Vienna by train to Neuchâtel, where her sons were waiting for her. She brought with her a letter from their sister, in which the Empress wrote that she and her husband were keen to discuss the possibilities of a peace deal, using her brothers as intermediaries to the Allied governments, but stating that it was vital that these negotiations be conducted with the utmost secrecy, for if Germany got wind of the plot, they would be furious to the extent that Austria feared what the retaliation might be. The brothers agreed and sent their mother back to Vienna with secret documents outlining the French proposals for a separate peace treaty that would allow Austria to quit the war. The emperor, his wife, and his foreign minister discussed this over the course of a week. Then they wrote down their counter-proposals, which were the documents they entrusted into the loyal hands of Count Erdődy, the delivery of which formed the start of this episode. It was Valentine's Day by the time Erdődy made it back to his family's palace in Vienna with its famous double-mirrored ballroom. The next day, he was at court, attending the emperor as if nothing was out of the ordinary. Aides did not attend every day, so nobody in the imperial entourage had noticed Erdődy's absence. The emperor's subterfuge had so far worked. A week later, Erdődy was back on the sleeper train to Neuchâtel for another exchange of secret communications. Again, the same minimal conversation in the house on the Rue de Pommier. Again, the same rapid turnaround back east to Vienna. With Erdődy's departure, Sixtus translated the emperor's proposals from German into French, then torched the originals, as his sister had ordered him to do. Then he and Xavier headed to the Neuchâtel train station, where they boarded a train northwest to Paris. Once they got there, they were driven to the Élysée Palace for a private audience with the French president Raymond Poincaré, who was encouraged by what he read in Prince Sixtus's translations. A separate Austrian peace deal seemed a tangible possibility, so long as Berlin was kept in the dark. Prince Sixtus told the president that in one of his sister's since incinerated letters, she had invited him and Xavier to come to Vienna to finalize the proposed terms in person, since, in her own words, half an hour of talk is better than a dozen journeys. There certainly were, to put it mildly, risks in trying to smuggle the brothers into Austria. But President Poincaré agreed with the Empress they would get more done with a few short meetings than they ever would by using intermediaries like the well-meaning but tactically quiet Erdödy. What had been proposed? What were the terms of this? What still needed to be discussed? Well, Austria was allied not just to Germany, but to Bulgaria and the Ottoman Empire, and some of the conditions for peace would impact those countries too. France had articulated four major conditions for peace with Austria. The first was that Austria would privately but firmly commit herself to supporting the French annexation of the western German provinces of Alsace-Lorraine, which Germany had annexed from France during a previous war in the 1870s. The sovereignty of Alsace-Lorraine was a huge source of contention between German and French nationalists. For some, it was the burning issue, and France wanted an Austrian commitment to recognizing that the provinces, referred to as the lost provinces in France, were, rightfully, French. When he read that condition, the Austrian foreign minister, Count Ottokar von Suren, had apparently drained of colour, since he knew that even the faintest hint of Alsace-Lorraine being returned to France would incite the wrath of many German nationalists. The second condition was that Austria would support the full restoration of Belgian independence after the war, and that it would likewise provide no objection to the re-establishment of Belgium's colonies in Africa. The third proposal was that the, or third condition, I should say, was that the Ottoman capital city of Constantinople, later Istanbul, would be handed over to the Russian Empire, thereby fulfilling centuries of Romanov and Eastern Orthodox dreams of retaking the ancient citadel of the Orthodox faith, which had been conquered by the Ottomans in 1453. The fourth condition was that the Austrian government would formally and irrevocably recognize the sovereign independence of the Kingdom of Serbia, whom many in Austria, including Empress Zita herself, blamed for starting the war in the first place. And as part of that recognition of sovereign independence, Austria would not oppose the expansion of Serbia's borders in any post-war settlement. The emperor had no objections to the second or third conditions. Austria had never participated in any of the European invasions of Africa, nor had she any involvement in the subsequent colonialisms in Africa or Asia. She had absolutely no intention of involving herself in it now. Likewise, for the proposed Russian occupation of Constantinople, which would have no economic or political impact on the Austro-Hungarian Empire's prospects in the years after the war. In any case, the Ottoman Empire was disintegrating, and it was likely only a matter of time before the Romanovs made a move on the old capital of Christian Orthodoxy. The emperor could thus agree to the second and third points easily. The first and fourth points, however, were a problem. Why did Austria need to sign off in Alsace-Lorraine? That was a German issue in the long run, not Austria's. And as for the fourth, well, Serbia was a sticking point. So it was Alsace-Lorraine and Serbia that would form the main bulk of any negotiations between the emperor and his brothers-in-law. On the last week of March, travelling under false names with forged passports, Prince Sixtus and Prince Xavier crossed the border from Switzerland into Austria. It had been a bitterly cold winter, and even though it was only a few days until the start of April, snow was still falling over Vienna when the brothers were driven through its streets from the train station to Count Erdödy's palace. There, they waited until the evening when another car arrived to take them to the Luxembourg on the outskirts of the city, part of an estate that had been owned by the Habsburgs since 1333. The brothers were brought round the side of the castle to be shown in through one of the castle's side doors, where their sister was waiting for them. Although this whole incident would later bear the name of her brother, referred to by historians as the Sixtus Affair, it was, far more than anybody else's, the brainchild of his sister Zita. Born in May 1892 in their family's Italian exile, christened after a popular local Catholic saint, and educated at convent schools in Bavaria and then Britain, Zita of Bourbon-Parma had married the future emperor in 1911. She had always been dubious about her adopted homeland's alliance with Germany, and through her work with the Red Cross, she was appalled and truly horrified by the war's humanitarian impact. She and her husband both lived in fear that the United States might soon enter the war on the side of France and its allies, sending thousands of fresh troops and munitions across the Atlantic, turning Austro-German defeat into a question of time rather than possibility. Zita was also, to her marrow, an old-school royalist who believed that there was still a way in which royals' connections could be used to broker alliances that changed the course of world events. The English diplomat and soldier Edward Lyle Strutt met Zita in 1919, 2 years after the events covered in this podcast episode. His assessment of her, read by actor Paul Storrs, is perhaps worth repeating here.
The Empress arrived wearing her wonderful pearls, although she looked pale and ill. About medium height and with a slim figure, she looked younger than her age, 26. The first impression I had of her was of her extraordinary strength of character, softened by her own remarkable charm. Determination was written in the lines of her square little chin. Intelligence was in her vivacious brown eyes, intellect in a broad forehead half hidden by masses of dark hair. Without possessing any extraordinary claims to beauty, the Empress could always attract attention in a crowd. As I entered the room, I realized that she must share, along with Belgium's Queen Elizabeth and Queen Marie of Romania, the honour of being one of the three great royal women of the war.
After the siblings embraced one another following 3 years apart, Zita escorted Sixtus and Xavier upstairs to her husband's rooms, where for the next 90 minutes they caught up on family news. Then the foreign minister, Count von Cernin, arrived. After he had bowed to her, Zita left the room. Despite or perhaps because of her great influence in her husband's government, Zita was always very careful to avoid appearing anywhere near as powerful as she actually was. Emperor Karl invited the three men to sit, and according to Prince Xavier, the first thing discussed was the Constantinople Clause, which Karl and Count von Cernin now wanted off the table. Abandoning two of their allies was best avoided where possible, and in the weeks since negotiations had begun, there had been a revolution in Russia. Nicholas II had abdicated and was now under house arrest with his immediate family just outside St. Petersburg. It was not clear if at some indeterminate point in the future the Russian crown might be revived to pass to Nicholas's younger brother, the Grand Duke Michael, or Russia might persist in the tentative republicanism it had adopted in the days immediately after Tsarism's collapse. But whatever happened, the disintegration of the Russian monarchy and the corresponding uncertainty of the country's future meant that neither Karl nor von Cernin felt there was any further need to discuss the sovereignty of Constantinople Istanbul. The conditions about Belgium were briefly discussed, being the least contentious of the four. The emperor and his ministers stood by their earlier promise that they would support the restoration of Belgian independence, and that Austria would, as she had for centuries, play no role in any colonial question. Serbia was then the topic of conversation. On this, Karl would not budge. Austria was not surrendering in these discussions, she was negotiating. After all, the Allies needed this peace deal just as much as did the Habsburgs. Karl offered to accept the first part of the Allied proposal. After the peace deal, his government would formally recognize the sovereign independence of the Serbian nation. However, it was a firm no on the second part of that proposal, which would have allowed Serbia to expand her territory in the post-war world. Austria would not, the emperor stated, under any circumstances, permit the extension of Serbian territory northwards into the Austrian-controlled provinces of Herzegovina or Bosnia. Nor would his government accept the French compromise proposal of allowing Serbia to expand south and westward into Albanian territory. As a gesture of goodwill, however, Karl promised that economic concessions would be granted in future trade deals, and that a deal would be proposed under which Serbian shipping had access to various imperial trading ports. Sixtus and Xavier, briefed beforehand by the French government, were prepared to accept the Austrian conditions on the Serbian clause. With Constantinople dismissed, Belgium agreed upon, and a compromise reached on Serbia, talk finally came to Alsace-Lorraine. My instinct, for what it's worth, is that Sixtus and Xavier already knew this next point before von Stirnen arrived, but we don't know that for certain. That next point is that the depths of the secrecy which the emperor and empress had resorted to in order to keep the negotiations hidden from German spies extended even to their own foreign ministry. For von Stirnen seemed to be under the impression that his emperor was simply discussing some peace proposals with France, which Austria would then take to her German, Bulgarian and Turkish allies once they were in firmer shape. Von Stirnen was not at all aware that the imperial couple were trying to pull off the diplomatic coup of a separate peace that left Germany to fight on without Austria-Hungary. Von Stirnen was terrified of German militarism, especially of the rising prominence of the militarist clique headed by the generals Ludendorff and von Hindenburg. Ludendorff, in particular, was known to intensely distrust the Austrian government. He had already placed spies in Austria to generate propaganda undermining Empress Zita's popularity. When Alsace-Lorraine was brought up at the Luxembourg, von Stirnen therefore panicked. Austria could not, under any circumstances, he said, discuss the province's sovereignty without a German representative present. For Vienna to contemplate getting involved, much less to side with France, as the two princes seemed to be suggesting, was political lunacy. In face of the foreign minister's fearful intransigence, the talks ended in stalemate, and the two brothers were driven back to the Erdödy's palace. The next evening, Count von Stirnen came there to speak personally with the brothers. He told them that as a loyal monarchist and subject, he would support and obey his emperor's commands, whatever they might be. However, he begged them never to underestimate what he kept referring to as the might of Germany, and what that might was quite prepared to do to its allies just as much as to its enemies. If the German high command found out what Karl was discussing, it would be disastrous. The following day, the emperor and empress, still at the Luxembourg, attended Mass for the Feast of the Annunciation, the church festival which commemorates the incarnation of Christ. Then they spent the day together drafting a written commitment of a peace deal that they would give to Sixtus to take to the French president. Despite von Stirnen's worries, they decided that this document would contain a firm, unambiguous promise that the Austrian crown would support the French reconquest of Alsace-Lorraine. At some point, Sixtus and Xavier were smuggled back into the castle to discuss the finer details with Karl and with Zita. Zita shrewdly suggested that her husband place several telephone calls over the course of the day to von Stirnen at the foreign ministry to ask him some questions about the diplomatic language they would use. It seems they did not make it explicitly clear to him that they were pressing ahead with the Alsatian element to the plan. They also decided to keep von Stirnen completely in the dark about one final clause, which for the French and their British allies was a non-negotiable. There would be no peace deal that in any way extended to Germany. This was for Austria and its empire alone. As Sixtus told Carl, "We would gladly conclude peace with you. But at the same time, the whole of France is firmly resolved to pursue the war with the utmost energy against Germany until she is finally and decisively defeated. It is my duty to draw your attention to this most important point. Nobody is ready to negotiate with Germany before she is beaten." Sixtus and Xavier took the Emperor's handwritten proposal with them and left Vienna, eventually returning to Paris to discuss how to proceed next. A week later, the United States entered the war and the Austrian sense of urgency increased. Sixtus was dispatched across the English Channel to London to a private meeting with Prime Minister David Lloyd George. He was enthusiastic at Emperor Karl's offer, although he worried a little that Britain's Italian allies, who had their eye on certain Austrian provinces, would feel aggrieved at a separate peace deal for Austria. The princes were sent back to Vienna in disguise once more. Although American entry had buoyed Allied confidence, it looked like another revolution was bearing down on Russia, which might mean the collapse of the entire Eastern European theatre of the war. If that happened, Germany would turn all her attentions westward. And so by summer 1917, both sides had new but sustained motivation to get this peace deal to work. Then, in the autumn, France had a new Prime Minister, Georges Clemenceau, whose intense nationalism earned him the nickname the Tiger. Clemenceau was less enthusiastic about negotiating with Austria, although he begrudgingly conceded there were some benefits to it. Until Count von Ciernin gave an interview in which he mocked and criticized Clemenceau, who in a moment of, I think, breathtaking self-absorption, retaliated by handing over to the press some of Emperor Karl's private memoranda on the peace deal. It was, as one journalist put it later, the journalistic coup of the decade. The disaster they feared had landed on Zita and Karl's doorstep. Sixtus had burned some of the earlier correspondence, but he had kept the later parts of it in order to prove the Emperor's good intentions and policy towards the Allied governments. There was plenty of proof. Seeing the articles break in the press, a hysterical Count von Ciernin arrived at the palace where he urged the Emperor to issue a statement denying authorship of any of the documents that were in his own hand. He had to deny were written in an official capacity, and he must state that at absolutely no point had he or von Ciernin discussed Alsace-Lorraine or Belgium. Two staggering lies that Karl agreed to tell to a totally disbelieving public. Normally an almost compulsively honest man, Emperor Karl's reputation was decimated by the statement, which prompted Prime Minister Clemenceau to respond by publishing even more of the Emperor's letters exchanged with Sixtus, proving that Alsace-Lorraine had been discussed and signed off on. Count von Ciernin suffered an alleged nervous breakdown and resigned as foreign minister, which the court chamberlain, Count von Berchtold, described as a dreadful scene. German propaganda renamed Zita the Italian schemer, and her reputation plummeted with her husband's, although many Austrians later admitted they had fully supported what the Empress had tried to do. Why Karl made himself appear so weak by denying the audaciousness of his plan is debated by historians. Some suspected blackmail, others blamed von Ciernin. But maybe the simplest answer is the correct one. He panicked, fearing German retaliation against him and his country. The main consequence of the Sixtus affair was a further weakening in Austria's position in the Great War. To save herself from German retaliation, the Habsburg Empire had to tie itself even more completely, obediently, to Berlin's policy. Empress Zita's great gamble had failed, and now all that was left for the Habsburg monarchy to do was to triumph or, as events proved, fall with Imperial Germany. Join me next week when we're back for a medieval visit of Henry VII's to Hampton Court, just in time for the UK publication of my next book. I've been Gareth Russell, and thank you so much for joining me.